Case number 06-1318, United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 204 et al. Petitioner.
I'm assuming everybody's ready to hear another.
Ms. Bowser for the petitioners. Ms. Heaney for the
your
respondent.
Your appointment is old as mine.
Lasky.
Your appointment is old as mine.
Excuse me.
I sometimes don't make it through all
the time. We'll be on next.
Yeah.
Morning, Council. Another one of the customs we don't follow from some other courts is we don't require the Council be called to the podium, so you may proceed, Council.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for the opportunity to argue on behalf of USCW 204 and the United States International Union. We believe that board orders with respect to its failure to find that the two top officials statements of plant closure were illegal, and its failure to provide meaningful and special access remedies were an abuse of discretion and should be overturned by this court.
Did you raise the special access remedies with the board?
Yes, yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. Tell us where.
Yeah, where?
We raised the special access remedies with the court. With the board in our objections to the ALJ's failure to order the bargaining that the company bargained with the union.
Right, you were seeking a bargaining order.
Yes.
So, but where did you argue for special rules in the absence of a bargaining order?
We didn't argue for special rules in the absence
right,
of a bargaining order.
Right, so you see,
we
don't have
the ultimate.
That leaves us without jurisdiction. You should have filed a petition for rehearing.
We believe that the issue of special access remedies was an issue because of the special bargaining order, the bargaining order that we argued for. And in cases like this, the board has over 25 years of ordering special access remedies in addition to the few remedies that they argued that they ordered of mailing the notice to the employees, having the board read the notice and sending out names and addresses to the union if upon request. We had no inkling that the board was going to just take the heart out of the special access remedies and substitute nothing in return. And this is an extraordinary situation since the board admitted that it was due to its own long and unexcusable delay. And based on its unexcusable
That's not unusual for the board, Johnson.
Well, based on its
long and unexcusable delay is not unusual for the NLRB. I mean, it may be becoming that way. I hope it is. But looking over our experience with the board over the years, that's not unusual.
But this case did not even have any meddlesome questions like the crime fraud exception like our other case had. This case was 6 years, and they were run-of-the-mill ULPs. And when the board summarily stripped out the collective bargaining order, the board had an obligation to otherwise fully remedy
Well, they did provide you remedies. They did provide you remedies. Now, to say an obligation to fully remedy, that cannot possibly imply that you get to dictate what the remedies are.
No, we cannot.
And what is our standard of review in reviewing board remedies?
Well, the standard of review is that this court in Teamsters Local 115 versus NORB said that the crucial factor in measuring the board's remedial power is the effect of the employer's illegal conduct for employees. And the same court in the same decision said notice and access remedies are designed to reassure interested parties of their rights and assist employees in hearing the union side of the story. And we submit that having the board agent read the notice, sending the notice to employees at their home,
What was the posture of Teamsters?
The posture of Teamsters was a situation where the board, I believe, imposed special access remedies.
Yeah.
The employer objected to that. But the rule is.
And we upheld the board's decision because our standard of review is a deferential one.
Correct. Right? Even though the standard of review is deferential, the court does have responsibility, as it said in General Electric versus NLRB in 1997. To examine carefully both the board's findings and its reasoning. And the court also said the court must take account of anything in the record which fairly detracts from the weight of evidence supporting the board's conclusion. So, and if the court said in another case, Randall Warehouse of Arizona versus NLRB, that the board cannot just ignore its own precedent, and stating that each case is different is not stating a reason why. And the court has said this, that the board has to give a reasoned explanation when it departs from its precedent.
What precedent did it depart from here, in your view, counsel?
It departed from its precedent with regard to the remedies. It departed from the
precedent. Right, it gave different remedies than it might have in some other case. But assuming you preserved your objection to the failure to include special access beyond what they did order, how is this access remedy that they imposed here and the one they didn't impose a breach of any prior precedent of the board? I guess prior precedent redundancy, any precedent of the board.
Okay. How it is that in over 25 years, in cases where you've had the two top management officials, the COO, chief operating officer, and president of the company of Smithfield Foods, coming to the plant for the first time and making threats of plant closure to the workers, the plant manager who's there day by day, and all sorts of other hallmark violations, threats of plant closure, threats of job loss, firing employees, threats of other sorts of threats of freezing the wage rates. When you've had that, and you've had that by the top officers of the plant, and you've had them personally involved, you've had extensive unfair labor practice, you've had pervasive unfair labor practice throughout the campaign, where an employer has had 3 months of meetings to touch all employees, had had films, had had speeches, and then you had the lower level managers in one or two, and then 10, 15 group meetings, the smaller group meetings, of employees expressly saying the company will close the plant. And you need to take into the totality of evidence. And in these types of cases, the board...
Right, even assuming that last finding were a finding of the board.
Pardon?
Even assuming that last finding were a finding of the board, that they expressly said the company will close the plant, still, what remedy did the board order here?
The board ordered the special access remedies of allowing the union to come into the plant, to make speeches to employees, mm-hmm. to be there in the plant, to respond to the employer speeches, and also to respond to the 25th hour speech, to post notices on the bulletin board. They ordered that in many, many cases.
They've ordered that in many, many cases. And they ordered that here, didn't they?
They did not order that here, no. They stripped out the remedy.
Right. Then why did you answer my question, what order did they order here by putting that in? Tell me what remedy they ordered here.
All they ordered here was the board agent read the notice to the employees. That was one of the orders. It hasn't taken place yet. The second thing that they ordered was that the same notice be mailed to the employees. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, they said if the union requests, they will be able to get the right names and addresses of the employees. Those are the only...
Now, what's the case in which you would have us look to find that the board has clearly violated its own precedent? Now, don't tell me the facts of this case again. Just tell me the precedent that you say they're violating by imposing that remedy.
I named about 10 or 15 cases.
Counsel, it's one thing to say that they imposed a different remedy in a different case. It's another thing to say they actually are in breach of their precedent in such a fashion that we should overturn a remedy given our deference. And I'm not finding in your brief or your argument now a precedent that they're actually in breach of here. They may be. There are different remedies in different cases.
I understand that, but when the same types of facts are present, when you have the involvement of high-ranking officials, in this case, the top officials, making threats, when you have threats of discharge, of plant closure, of loss of jobs, of freezing the wages, when you have all those threats in a constant drumbeat for over a three-month period, in the cases where you had that and even had less, the board has systematically ordered that special access remedies be imposed. Of course, the different details of facts can be different, but in the type of cases where you've had these hallmark violations and other egregious violations The type of remedy that had been imposed is not the mere cease and desist order and the reading and mailing of the notice. They ordered those things, but they also...
You also had the information upon demand here, the employee information on demand, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They imposed three remedies.
Yeah.
Employee information, names and addresses upon demand, the mailing of the notice, and the reading of the notice.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, in cases, and I set out at least 15 cases over the years, and there are more, that where the board, in situations that mirror this situation, have taken much more stringent action. In this case, the board said, because of the Smithfield Targo case, which the D.C. Circuit decided last year, that this is further evidence that this employer has a proclivity to violate the act. In other words, this is a serial labor law violator. They have destroyed the laboratory conditions of three elections within 6 years, within a few miles of the other. This is not a company that who had wayward managers going astray and doing the wrong thing. You had the top company official, the COO and president, coming down and telling the employees that don't hang the UFCW around your neck. The UFCW was the cause of losing for these employees three times in the past.
They didn't say that. They were very careful to say, you know, I don't know what the cause was, right?
Well, they were...
Those are their words. Didn't they say that?
Yeah, that's what...
Didn't they say that? Yes or no? They said, I don't know the cause.
Yes, sir, but,
okay.
But what this court has said, you look at the totality...
I understand. I understand.
You look at whether, when someone says...
No, I understand. I think we all understand totality of circumstances. I was just picking at your one point when you said that the top official said the union caused the problem. They didn't say that. The totality of the circumstances is a different argument, but they...
Yes, they did. They said the top official, Mr. Little, said there are two courses of action in this plant. There's expansion or not expansion. And he went on to say that expansion was never achieved in this building by the three other companies. They all had the UFCW, and they all failed here. That is blame.
Is that accurate or not?
They all had the UFCW, but the last plant, John Morrell, closed within 6 months of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no collective bargaining agreement. There was no evidence that the UFCW made it fail.
Right.
In fact,
you're backing away from the question. Question was it accurate to have said they all had USCW and it failed?
Yes, that's right. Accurate. But they went on to blame. They put the blame on the UFCW.
The
plant manager, Phil Price, said the UFCW has a terrible track record in this building. The UFCW is obviously a drinks for this plant. They struck out for Wilson employees three times. It's time for another approach. If that's not blaming the UFCW for the past closures and suggesting that the same thing will happen for this election period, I don't know what is. You don't have to use the words plant closure to be threatening plant closure. And when the human resources director says, I hope that people would see all the lives and families that have been damaged by the UFCW in this building and this community and vote no. The Smithfield Packing cannot run an effective business with a third party. Nowhere in any of their statements was there any economic basis for those statements. And the Supreme Court in Gissel, in NLRB versus Gissel Packing, requires an economic basis for any predictions, even if it's a may prediction. This may happen, it may not. There still has to be economic facts as a basis.
Counsel,
I understand what you're saying, but would you put your argument in the context of our standard of review here, which is very deferential, right? Allegheny-Ludlam, it says the court must recognize, that's talking about us, the court must recognize the board's competence in the first instance to judge the impact of utterances made in the context of the employer-employee relationship. So, you know, even if I were to agree with you about all this, we can't just set aside the board's view because we disagree with it. We have to give the board the board has to be able to, the board in the first instance has to judge the impact. And we can't, so how do you argue that your view justifies upsetting the board's determination to which we owe deference? What is it about what the employer did here that requires that?
The court does owe deference, but when the board itself has, in this case, has highlighted the various times over, it's as if there's a play here. You have the top people making somewhat thinly veiled statements, but then you have the rest of the cast coming out openly and saying that they're going to close the plant in various forms. And what the board is required to do is look at all of those as a whole. You can't separate what the board tries to do. The board tries to separate Human Resources Director's Gilliard statements saying that the UFCW drove the people out of the plant from the plant manager's statements that said John Morrell Company, it too ended up with union trouble. What the court, I believe, even though differential, has to say, what is the bottom line here? This court said, what do the employees hear?
But that's not the standard we're supposed to look at. What is the bottom line? We're supposed to see if there's a rational basis for what the board did. And are you saying there's no rational basis for the board to conclude that that the statements that were made were not threats of reprisal, were just predictions of what would happen?
No,
that's your argument, right?
The board is exalting form over substance. The board is saying that if you say that they failed here three times, they closed the plant three times, don't hang them around, don't hang the UFCW around your neck the fourth time. Oh, but we didn't say plant closure.
Help me to understand. I don't understand.
Does not have to play word games with the company.
I find the precedent here somewhat confusing to me, and maybe you can help me understand it a little bit. I'm going to give you a hypothetical situation. Had the management said here, if the union is organized, if you vote to organize the union, management has already decided we're going to close the plant, would that have been appropriate or inappropriate?
That would be inappropriate.
But Gissel says that's appropriate, and I don't understand that.
Gissel
says that, gives that as an example of something appropriate. Says it's appropriate to convey a management decision already arrived at to close the plant in case of unionization. And I don't understand that.
No, Gissel doesn't say that.
I just read from Gissel.
Gissel says that if the employer can make a prediction of that or say that we're going to do this.
Let me read you the language from Gissel, and maybe the copy I have is wrong or something, but it's. In such a case, however, the prediction must be carefully phrased on the basis of objective fact to convey an employer's belief as to demonstrably probable consequences beyond his control, or to convey a management decision already arrived at to close the plant in case of unionization. I just don't know what that means.
Well, we know from the Supreme Court case of Darlington that an employer says that they're going to close the plant if you unionize it. That's a violation of the law. So,
but that's what they said in Darlington.
I don't think
that's what they said in Darlington. Yeah, they didn't have to find any implication in Darlington. Roger.
The whole company, the employer can certainly go out of business totally, but for the employer to say that I'm going to close this plant because of unionization, that would be a violation. Here, what they've said is that we are predicting that the union will cause us to go out of business. We're not saying that it will, but we're saying that it may. And there were no economic facts on which they had to base it. Quite the contrary. This union, as Mr. Little, the COO, admitted on the stand, has unionized plants with the UFCW that are quite successful. So that shows it was even further misleading when they said we cannot do business with a third party. And I agree that the standard is deferential, but there still is some standard for making sure that the board acts consistent with its reasoning over time or else explains more fully the departure from its reasoning.
Okay, unless there are further questions, I think we've been into your red light time for a little while now. So thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
Thank you. Do I have any more time?
You don't. If needed, we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if you need it after we hear from the... Okay.
The second issue before the court today is whether the board rationally found that the company did not engage in unlawful surveillance of its employees. And finally, the board of the union challenges the adequacy of the board's remedy. With regard to the first issue, the alleged unlawful further closure, the employer has a right to free speech, and he can express his opinions, thoughts, and views regarding unionism as long as his expressions do not contain any promise of benefit or threat of reprisal. And in that regard, an employer...
If Prince and Little had said what Gilliard said, would this be a much different case?
When you say what Gilliard said, I assume you're referring to statements made by him in the...
In the videotape, yes, ma'am. Yeah.
I believe it would be a different case. Gilliard's statement made specific references to causation. Mm-hmm.
So when you take the two together and look at the totality of the circumstances, what does that do?
Well, first, as a procedural note, the statements that the union counsel repeatedly referred to in her brief, Gilliard statements, were not found to be ULPs and were not alleged to be that way.
But they're part of the context.
They are part of the context.
And even the board said that.
And the board did consider that as part of the context and rationally concluded that even those statements made by Gilliard did not alter the essential message of Price and Little's comments, which was a factual, purely factual message.
Where did the board consider the Gilliard tape, the Gilliard video?
In the footnotes, I believe it's right prior to Member Lehman's dissent, the board notes the fact that it wore it to...
I think it's footnote 13, if I'm
footnote
correct.
Footnote 13. I'm reading there. And the board did consider all the circumstances.
How could the board have considered that in context? How could it possibly be that if somebody says, quote, the union... Well, it does, this isn't a quote. It says the union pretty much ran the company out of business. That's what Gilliard said.
Correct.
So, and you also had the ALJ made two supervisors, right?
Correct.
These fellows, Brown and White?
Brown,
right?
Yeah.
Brown and White, yeah.
Although they should say.
Yeah. They had threatened closures, right?
Correct.
Okay, and that's all part of the, quote, context, correct?
Correct.
So, now... Explain to me how, when you take those three instances into account, the two unfair labor practices and the Gilliard statement, that you could review the context of this and conclude that that the employees would not have viewed this as a threat to close the plant?
Because the employer, as I said, has a right to convey his opinion.
No, but I'm focusing on, here's my question. If it weren't for the ALJ's two findings of an unfair labor practice, in the Gilliard video. I understand your argument. Your argument is all these speeches, they talked about the union in the past and the plant's closing, but they were all very careful to say, right, that they don't know what happened, right? They all have those caveats in there. But now we've got these three instances where there weren't. And where does the board say, okay, we've taken account of these three, and for the following reasons, we still don't think they produce a different result. Doesn't the board have to evaluate all the evidence in the record, including the evidence that's contrary to its findings?
I would submit that the board did do that. It states in its footnote, when we consider the full circumstances, and by full circumstances, they are referring to the UL, the two prior ULPs for Brown and Lane, and to Gilliard's statements in the video. And those other statements and the two ULPs don't alter.
But doesn't the board have to give us, the board's entitled to great deference here. But doesn't the board, in order to get that deference, isn't the quid pro quo that it gives a reason to which we can defer?
The reason would be...
What is the reason? Why is it that, even given this context, these statements are still not threatening?
Because it doesn't change what the board said in the text of its opinion itself, that the employer never threatened closure. Little and Price never communicated to the employees that if you were to choose...
But these other three people did.
Correct.
Brown and White and Gilliard.
But Price and Little did not. They told the employees...
Why didn't the board say something like, you know, Price and Little were more senior, they conveyed the sense of the company, and Gilliard was a rogue agent or something. But they didn't say anything like that, I think, is part of the point. They didn't get the benefit of the counsel of McGuire Woods.
Honestly, this case really is all about informing your employee electorate and the employee code to check the ballot box, yes or no. I think that employee would like to know that the union they're about to select had been represented three other prior businesses at this exact same establishment, and all three prior businesses had failed. And the employer had the right to convey that factual information to its employee. And the fact that the conveying of that information, that factual information, occurred within a context that possibly is riddled with other ULPs does not alter the context of the employer's truthful and accurate message. And if you don't have any other questions about closure, I'll move on quite quickly to the remaining two issues.
Yeah, let me jump ahead on the surveillance issue. Here's my question. If I agreed with you that there was a sufficient reason to use to turn the camera on the employees because of the trespass issue, were there any instances of trespass after that initial outburst? I mean, the camera was on for what, 3 months? Is that right? And
right.
How many instances of trespass were there after the initial spasm? So how long does that justify surveillance? You say 3 months here. Would it justify 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years?
The union never offered the company any assurances that it was not going to trespass again. And given the union's complete bravado in ignoring Security Officer Pittman's request over and over, please stop crossing over the property line that I've lineated.
Over and over.
Given that this is at the perimeter of the property, why would management, why would the ownership need any justification for having surveillance cameras there? I'm not sure why it not only justified it for 3 months, it didn't justify it forever if they wanted to keep their cameras there.
They can certainly keep the union off of their, employer's property, and they have a right to protect their employees from trespass.
I have a question about the board's reasoning here in the testimony. The board said that the general counsel didn't offer any evidence to contradict the guard's testimony that he redirected the security camera in order to monitor any further trespasses, right?
Correct.
Okay. But if Pittman's testimony doesn't really say that. It says, he says, I turned the camera down. I turned the camera down as they were in a property. Question. He said, I turned the camera on in case we needed some kind of documentation, right? That they were in fact on our property. And then the questioning goes on, by documentation, why do you think you need it? Answer, I was planning to charge them with trespass. And I figured it would be to my best interest if I had it on tape. Okay? So he didn't say he was using the video. He was using the video to monitor. See, in your brief, you say in the brief that he was using the video camera. He was using the video, right, which was right in the guard booth, to determine whether they were trespassing. He didn't say that. He said he wanted to document the trespassing by videotaping it. And then there was testimony in the record that you could look at the leafleters right from the guard booth. But you didn't need the video camera to do that. So what I'm getting at is, where's the evidentiary base in the record for the board's conclusion that they were doing this to monitor, to keep an eye on the workers, on the leaflet?
I think that your question comes down to almost but not quite.
Comes down to what?
Almost but not quite semantics. When the board says Pittman was, or the company was using the video camera to monitor the surveillance, and Pittman was saying himself that I was using it to keep track of whether or not the employees were crossing the line.
That's not what he said. That's not what Pittman said. That's what the board says Pittman says. What Pittman said was that he wanted to keep a film record of it and to, as evidence to support a trespass prosecution.
He does say that.
That's what he says. He didn't say that. And there's this evidence here from a witness that you could, just sitting in the guard booth, you could see what was going on. So he didn't need the screen to be able to see what was going on contemporaneously. All he had to do was look out the window. You're aware of that testimony, right?
Yes, I am very much aware of
that. So you see why I'm asking the question. Right. What's the record support for the board's reasoning?
The support in the record, yeah, I think, would come from the union's actions prior to the switching of the camera. The union's repeated determination to cross the property line, and its repeated determination not to listen to the security guard's request, please stay on the other side of the line.
I understand all that, but the board, we're looking for we're evaluating the board's justification for saying this wasn't unlawful surveillance, right? And they said it wasn't unlawful surveillance because he was looking at the video screen in order to do contemporaneous monitoring of the leaflets, right?
Right.
Okay. But that's not what Pittman said. That's not what Pittman said he was doing. So where did the board find evidence that he was doing it for contemporaneous observation purposes? And where did the board deal with the fact that witness, uncontradicted, said you could see what these guys were doing from the bar?
I actually don't recall whether or not Pittman himself said he could see from the guard booth. And I believe
what difference does that make?
Well, he's the one looking. He himself may need the aid of the camera, but I will admit that's not in the record.
Oh.
What you have is Pittman's testimony that he was using the camera, and he did say that he was going to use it, and I think the quote is in anticipation of litigation.
But then you would have expected that the board would have challenged this employee's testimony on the record, would have cross-examined him. He said specifically, I can look straight across the driveway and see the people standing out on the front row. No one challenged him.
Yes. I noticed on caught over my
Yeah, you've been over your time a good while too, so unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll call the red light call on you also. I think we have an intervener with some time allotted in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Catherine. The short amount of time allotted in this case.
Thank you very much. Douglas M. Polsky, and I am counsel for the interveners. I think I can answer a couple of the court's questions pretty quickly, and that's what I'd like to spend my time doing, if you like. With respect to the video issue, I think the evidence was that the camera was directed in order to catch trespassers. Mr. Pittman said he kept the camera directed there so that he would have video evidence of the trespassing if it occurred. And the board's rationale was based upon the fact that once the employer articulates a reason for the surveillance, then under current board law, that was appropriate.
Yeah, do you see any significance to the evidence that the guard could also see what he was filming? I mean, it seemed to me that would be the norm. I'm not seeing any problem with it, are you?
Well, I don't see any problem with it either, Your Honor. And Justice Tell, the other thing is, while you may be able to see where they're handling from that guard shack, and the record may not be clear on this, you certainly wouldn't be able to see the property line as to whether the organizers are crossing it.
Okay.
And, you know, the other thing to point out about these surveillance is important is you can't see the employee faces in the tape, and the tape was being taped over, so they clearly weren't surveilling the employee conduct. The other thing is, I would point out with respect to the surveillance, is I don't think there's any evidence in the record that any employee ever thought they were being surveilled while they were handling. So again, when you take a look at what the standard for 8A1 is, was the conduct perceived to be coercive, or was it?
By the way, did the board say that?
Pardon me?
Did the board say that?
I'm not sure whether the board said that or not, but
The board didn't say that there was no evidence that any employee, no employee thought they were being surveilled.
I don't believe the board said that, Your Honor.
Because I didn't hear that until just, I don't remember that. That's news to me if the board did. You understand why I'm asking the question?
Yes, I do. But it's not a reason to support the board's decision.
No, wait. Then you don't understand why I'm asking the question.
Help me out, Your Honor.
I'm asking the question because we can't affirm the board for a reason it doesn't give. For a reason you give, but it doesn't.
Well, that may very well be true.
It's not may very well be true. That's sort of basic administrative law here.
The absence of the testimony supports the board's conclusion that it was not coercive.
But the board didn't say that.
But the record is wrong.
Okay. Well, what's your other point?
I understand what you're saying. I'd like to talk for a couple of seconds about Mr. Gilliard's comments, since they seem to be somewhat of an issue here. I'm not willing to concede that Mr. Gilliard either made any threats or made any predictions. Number one, I think the board was clear, the record's clear, that they can't form the basis of an unfair labor practice charge initially. That's number one. While they can do some back, they can form the background of the situation. All right. I think, once again, when you take a look at what Mr. Gilliard said, it's what the union's been doing throughout the entire case, and that is to pull things out of context and then ask you to take a look at conclusions or specific statements as opposed to the context of the situation. When Mr. Gilliard talked about the Swift incident, for example, which came up, and he says, from what I am seeing, it looks as if the union might have run Swift out of business. If you take a look at the next page of the transcript in the video, there is a comment from Buck Jackson, who was a Wilson employee who worked in Swift, that justifies that.
Didn't the board itself draw a sharp distinction between Gilliard's statement and the statements of the others?
Yes.
Even the board thought that Gilliard's statements were problematic. But
they
didn't consider it, but that was for procedural
people.
Reasons.
Pardon?
That was for procedural reasons.
That's right.
You're arguing something here again the board didn't say. I mean, the board contrasted Price and his others to what Gilliard said. At least they didn't say what Gilliard said.
Well, I'm not sure the board went that far, Ryan. I'm really not. I don't think that's what the board said. Yeah. But my point is...
Do you agree with me that the board did contrast the two?
I think they mentioned the two, yes. But I don't think the board assumed that in the absence of the procedural issue that Gilliard's statements would be an unfair labor practice.
I didn't say that.
And I just want to make sure that...
I didn't say that.
That the court takes a look at the whole record and takes a look at Gilliard's statements in a context of the entire video. And I think that's important.
Gilliard says, quote, it is a fact. It is a, quote, fact. That the union had an impact on Swift closing its doors.
I think that is a fact. And if you take a look at Mr. Buck Jackson's commentary on page 170 of the Joint Appendix, he supports that. There was a strike at Swift caused by the UFCW. I think that would support the fact that there is that the UFCW did have an impact. Now, Mr. Gilliard didn't say that the UFCW caused Swift to close. And Mr. Gilliard never predicted that if the union got in, the plant would close. And I think Mr. Price's comments and Mr. Little's comments said directly the opposite. And I think that's an important distinction to make.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up also, counsel. It seems to be the norm in this particular case. We'll respondent had no time left, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
I just simply wanted to remind the court of the total context of this case and why the board itself said that in light of the Cargill case in which this court decided last year that Smithfield has proved itself to be, has further proved itself to have proclivity to violate the act. These were, the context of this is for 3 months the workers were pummeled with daily meetings by top officials, mid-level officials, and in smaller group meetings, individual supervisors. This was not rogue employees going astray and making statements. The statements that Gilliard made in his video mirrored the statements that the plant manager made in speeches July 17th and 18th at Joint Appendix 231, 232. The statements that Little made, also mirrored statements that Gilliard made. We're talking about an orchestrated process by one of the biggest companies in the world on a daily basis covering all employees in group meetings and saying the same thing, sometimes very artfully, sometimes very just, you know, knock you in the head, we're going to close it, other times thinly veiled. This was a drumbeat to the employees. And I say that to say that when you take it into context and you read Price's statements to employees in June with his letter to employees 2 days before the election, when you read Gilliard's statements in the video with Price's statements and the Little statements when the head of the company comes down, and when you look at...
Your red light is back on, counsel.
I appreciate it.
Thanks to all, counsel, and give us recess.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m.
Thank you.